I know that this is going to confuse people, but here is where I stand. I support a one-state solution in Palestine. I support the BDS movement. I believe that the Israel lobby has a ridiculously disproportionate influence over US domestic politics at the congressional level and, more importantly, at the street level. But I firmly believe that the idea that the Israel lobby determines in any manner or degree US foreign policy is utterly stupid. Out here that it's not that I feel I'm against everyone in my beliefs. Rather, I feel that my beliefs put everyone against me. I mean, I admire Jeff Blankfort and Noam Chomsky, I admire Stephen Zunes and Stephen Gowans, but I see ways in which every one of these guys is guilty of inadvertently, though sometimes rather willfully, becoming apologists for and ideological supporters of US imperialism. On the other hand, however, I see nothing admirable nor even excusable in Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, who are not only more fatuous than the aforementioned, but also, given their professorial positions as political scientists and so-called neorealists, they do not have any excuse for being such idiots. So, how did I get to be this neither fish nor fowl creature? And how can I persuade you to join me in this annoying world where weighty matters are not reducible to sound bites? Firstly, I can point out that there is a simple way of looking at these things. The idea that a tiny state such as Israel, a virtual dependency of the US, dictates US foreign policy is silly. It's that simple. It is the very same far-fetched excuse as those who suggest that the US was drawn into the Korean War by the machinations of Syngman Rhee and drawn into Indochina by systemic inertia. This is blatant apologism for repeated acts of genocide, whose fundamental similarities alone are enough to indicate intentionality. But I am aware that my simply stating this stuff leaves much to be desired and much to be answered. Particularly, what are the drivers of US foreign policy, and why do I so confidently discount the role of the Israel lobby in this when it is demonstrably powerful in US politics? Before I start, however, I'd like to have a little bit of a self-pitying whinge. I'm aware that I'm probably making no friends by taking a stance which contradicts everyone else's stance. But instead of getting angry at me for taking much the same line as Zunes and Chomsky, remember that I'm also alienating those people who agree with Chomsky on the subject of Palestine. A dying breed, admittedly. Before you write to gainsay my claims, I would ask the following matters be of consideration. 1. That you ask yourself, can your stance be reconciled with the pattern of historical events, including analogous situations, such that you are not claiming some peculiar exceptionalism for US society that you would find unreasonable in other societies? 2. Is there a theoretical consistency to what you are claiming, or does the attempt to translate into theoretical terms expose contradictions which once again are suggestive of an insupportable claim of exceptionalism? You might ask yourself, what theory? What is this guy on about? The fact is, however, that each time you link a cause with an effect, you are doing so in theoretical terms. What I'm concerned about is that those of you who might have a worldview wherein their theories are self-contradictory and create paradoxes. Now, one last thing remains with regard to the fact that I choose to comment on matters where I disagree with everyone. Well, I could do otherwise. I could choose to be more agreeable and choose a path of greater agreement. But the result might be a little bit like, so I hear the Earth actually circles the Sun. I reckon that's probably true, so maybe we can agree on that. They tell me, too, that the majority of dogs have four legs and, you know, well, it's only anecdotal, but almost every single dog I've ever seen has had four legs, and I've seen quite a few dogs. They also say that Hitler wasn't a very nice person. I'd more or less agree with that proposition. They didn't give him a Nobel Prize, which is probably a good thing. I think we can agree on that. I mean, they must have been tempted. You know, if they're like they are now, they'd be tempted to give them a Nobel Peace Prize for their whole non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. You know, Hitler and Stalin would have got a peace prize for that now, wouldn't they? I reckon they would. And then Hitler, instead of killing himself, he could have simply pointed out that he was sincere. That he sincerely believed that Jews were a form of demographic weapon of mass destruction, and that Poland was in possession of millions of weapons of mass destruction with the potential to reach as far as New York City if they weren't denied entry. He could have become a peace envoy, just like Tony Blair, trying to find common ground in decolonizing struggles such as in Indonesia or Indochina. Sorry, I got a bit off track there, but you get my point, which is that if I talked about what I agreed with, I would be boring and pointless, and then I'd just start making stupid jokes, just to relieve the tedium. At this point, I was going to introduce matters with a brief summary of what I had written in another context about the US Empire. But it is too complicated, and can't be presented in theoretical terms because existing theory, as we shall see, is slightly inadequate. So I have created a PDF from the excerpt with a grafted-on bit about why there was a strategic imperative for the US Empire to commit genocide in Iraq. Okay, it's massive, but look through it, and I will summarize the pertinent bits for you here, and hopefully you can see that my reasoning is based on solid evidence. The US Empire is based on power structures, which are now often referred to, not unreasonably, as corporatist. Corporatism is as good a word as any, but it should not be linked explicitly with fascism per se. Structurally, it's akin to feudalism in that it accords so-called regnal rights to entities which are not theoretically sovereign. Indeed, US corporatism is the continuity of that form of regime, that is feudal, which has persisted through transitions from feudal to early modern mercantilist to liberal. In the year 1900, its highest expression was the liberal British Empire. There was no, quote, revolving door at this time. Government and private interests only separated when circumstances dictated that they must. The supposedly sovereign governmental structure constituted far, far less than half of the state power wielded in the imperial polity. In 1902, John Hobson noted that the British Empire was a drain on the wealth of the majority of the people of Britain and the majority of capitalist enterprises in Britain. He wrote, quote, "Seeing that the imperialism of the last three decades is clearly condemned as a business policy in that at enormous expense it has procured a small, bad, unsafe increase of markets and has jeopardized the entire wealth of the nation in rousing strong resentment of other nations, we may ask, how is the British nation induced to embark upon such unsound business? The only possible answer is that the business interests of the nation as a whole are subordinated to those of certain sectional interests that usurp control of the national resources and use them for their private gain." End quote. But these certain sectional interests were far from random. Shipping, coal, arms, finance, and military contracting. These were the beneficiaries of empire, but they were also the tools of empire. These are strategic industries. They were the British military-industrial complex, the empire complex, if you will. None of these interests were separable from the crown, nor, more to the point, was the reverse the case. The English had transitioned from feudalism by transforming it into mercantile terms, awarding charters and patents and so forth, and into liberal Lockean terms by allowing enclosure and outright ownership to effectively deepen privilege rather than challenge it. It is true that they instituted direct rule in India and ended private imperialism through the East India Company, but this was occurring at a time of the expansion of scope, depth, and complexity of state power, and much of it was in non-governmental hands. And the Bank of England here can serve as a good example. After this, British corporate rule was part of the informal empire, which included more or less the entirety of South America and semi-formal possessions like Egypt. These places were run by private British finance interests interpenetrated with other empire complex interests, which were, of course, interpenetrated by Her Majesty's government, and, crucially, could rely on military incursions and other interstate actions when required. If there were strategic sectional interests making up the empire complex, then there were also strategic resources. Mainly this meant coaling stations at this level at this time, and the British were able to use their naval supremacy to ensure their naval supremacy. Gold, however, was also a form of strategic resource, and it is important to note that the British view of gold was that strategic denial was as good as possession. If they couldn't have it, then they would make sure that no one else would get it, thus bolstering the value of their own reserves. Then the British discovered the potential of oil, a strategic resource like no other, which combined these properties of coal in that it empowered the owner to retain power, but also had the strategic properties of gold, in that you could use strategic denial to bolster your own the value of your own holdings. So, while the French were bled white on the Western Front, the British used the cover of World War I to go on a massive oil grab. By 1920, they had virtually cornered the entire world supply outside of the United States. But, in the process, they had ceded financial hegemony to New York and Washington, thanks to the war costs. An Anglo-US petroleum condominium later formed and became the basis of a shared empire complex in which the UK was the junior partner. Domination of oil meant the ability to deny all hard power, economic or military, to those reliant on those petrochemical resources. For complicated reasons, which you can read all about in the aforementioned PDF if you want, the US also chose to tie its financial hegemony directly to its ability to militarily dominate oil resources. Nowadays, the empire complex is far more expanded than that of the British Empire. It includes a large array of so-called sectional interests, which are all of direct strategic relevance. Many are related to matters of life and death. For example, arms and military, water, energy, pharmaceuticals, and food. Others are similarly fundamental to societal functioning, such as finance and the media. This is not about an iron triangle. These are interlocking iron triangles, and profit is both central and incidental at the same time. That is how it works. The sectional interests are the imperial state, but they cannot dominate the imperial state for some hypothetical private ends that are separate from the imperial ends. The other thing to note is that imperial elites are not tied to the interests of the mother state, nor the people thereof, nor the people of the subjugated regions. They are almost entirely independent of the welfare of nations and their peoples, and almost entirely dependent on the massive, unrelenting, centripetal, coercive power which holds empires together. That is why they kill so many people and ravage whole societies and economies. That is, in very simple terms, why empires are as inherently genocidal as settler colonial enterprises. This is also why many empires all but destroy their home economies. The Romans did, the Spanish did, the British did, and now the US does with deindustrialization, outsourcing, and so forth. There is also the need to maintain stratification domestically, which you may also read about in the attached PDF if you want. In theory terms, what I'm proposing here is a form of realism, in that it doesn't have anything to do with national character or ethics or specific ideologies and so forth. The power relations determine the behaviours. Traditionally, realism is often distrusted as being inherently amoral and for being the kind of apologism because it implies that horrendous behaviour is the result of inevitable laws. There is a logical fallacy in this, however, in that realists might recognise potential ways of diminishing the capacity to inflict mass violence and the possible advantages to be gained through mass violence. What they tend to emphasise, however, is the continuity of strategic interests that are not altered by idealism or ideology, the personality of rulers, or the theology of governments. Realism is about power relations. One result of this is that it may have a normative aspect, which is a term used by academics to describe their own prescriptiveness. Thus, a realist might proclaim that it was a horrible mistake by France to alienate and attack the newly formed Soviet Union when they had inevitable shared interests. It is quite a strong realist current that includes progenitors such as Hobbes and Machiavelli, but in modern self-professed realists, It does tend to beg the question of why, if reality is failing to live up to allegedly realist norms, the term realism is applied to what, in the final analysis, is the promotion of an ideal of amoral power relations. The fact is, if you're going to call yourself a realist, then more than a tiny bit of normative content indicates a broken model. Realism, by its very nature, should be able to accommodate actuality within its analytical framework. And, to be quite honest, it could only be academics that might seriously take real political actors to task for not acting real enough. So, proper realism requires a model which reflects actuality. Realism evolved in a fairly empirical manner as a counter to mythologized anthropomorphism and idealism. It was clear that changes in regime and ruler did not prevent repeated patterns of behavior. I plan to say more on this, but I'm going to have to cut it short. Suffice it to say that realism evolved from being centered on the nation-state to neo-realism, or structural realism, which posits constraints on the nation-state on nation-state behavior through international structure. And this has been built on and challenged in various ways. Standing apart from this sort of realist are a bunch of lowercase realists, meaning that the realists I have previously been talking about are capitalized and part of a school, whereas these lowercase realists are people who are basically realistic but not aligned to a given dogma. The most obvious one of these is Noam Chomsky, who takes a clearly realist stance, but one that emphasizes elite interests and elite power over the nation-state and its security. Others are similarly realistic in outlook, but unattached to a school of thought. They're agnostic realists, and they tend to look for confluences of imperatives and powers rather than impose a prior framework. So here is where my stance fits in with all of that. And I apologize for any jargon and oversimplification, but this is all taking a bit too long to explain as it is. One, nation-states belong in the classical realist model to a large extent. Two, empires do not. Three, the world and its people do not function under a paradigm of relative gains, except in some immediate circumstances, but imperial power does. Four, nation-state elites are tied to the welfare of the nation-state and its people. Imperial elites are less so or not so, or may even benefit in relative gains terms from immiseration. Now, I'm using nation-state here to stand in for any unitary polity, which in some degree might include some historical empires. But if you squint your eyes, you'll see what I'm getting at. Anyway, you can see a good example of the difference between a unitary polity and its ruling regime and an imperial regime in Mike Davis's late Victorian Holocaust, wherein the British Empire destroyed the communal economic resources and famine protections existing in parts of India, and also did similar things elsewhere, but mainly in India. And when drought hit, millions and millions of people died in famines in British India, whereas neighbouring princely states, which were weaker and poorer, did not suffer from famine. So, I'm saying that in realist terms, that empires are run by imperialists who cannot help but serve the imperial interest, such as it is. The US Empire has committed genocides in Korea, Indochina, and Iraq, and each time Pollyannaish opponents have squealed that such things are not in the national interest. Well, maybe not, but as the US continues its rollout of new regimes in the Middle East and bullies most of the states of the world most of the time into doing its bidding, it's very difficult to see how so much power was accrued through so many mistakes. Security is often a fetish for political analysts, and not just realists. I believe this has more to do with a desire for vicarious drama and a sense of self-importance than with actual issues of security. There is a whole bunch of academics who I tend to think of as the security geeks. They style themselves as latter-day players of the great game on the grand chessboard, living out puerile fantasies of power and relevance. Most of them are uppercase realists, and they tend to be in think tanks or university departments with strategic in the title. These people believe that US, the UK, and NATO actions are undertaken for genuine security reasons. If not security reasons, they are inclined to accept humanitarian intervention or reject it, but they don't question its sincerity. In other words, these people are hopelessly naive and easy prey for ruthless political and military leaders. What makes them more to be loathed than pitied is their unbelievable arrogance. Iraq is the perfect example. A security threat that even these idiots couldn't believe in. When faced with the plain and very clear fact that political leaders were lying about a security threat, no, let me be more specific than that. When faced with the fact that political leaders were engaged in a very complex, systematic attempt to deceive not only through lying, but through misrepresentation, dissimulation, and the manufacture of fraudulent evidence, when faced with that, did they say, "Oh my goodness, these people are lying to us. They're making huge efforts to try and deceive us. They must be covering something up." No, not a chance. They smugly pronounced that they were not deceived, unlike the political leaders who were so incredibly less intelligent than clever people like them that they believed their own lies. Well done, guys. You spotted that Iraq wasn't really a security threat, even if some of you were a bit slow on it. That's right, not a big security threat to the United States like all those other really threatening poor countries, such as Laos, Haiti, and Panama. Let's not forget that tropical menace to world peace known as Grenada. What about Nicaragua? And Reagan's assertion that if the Sandinistas weren't defeated, then there would be Soviet tanks rolling across the Rio Grande. Do you remember Jack Nicholson in that movie saying, "You can't handle the truth"? Well, the truth referred to and embraced by the movie was that only savage men like Nicholson could provide freedom. How? By occupying Guantanamo, that well-known bastion of freedom. According to the movie, lives are saved by vicious, thuggish frontiersmen who have to face down the iron-disciplined and robotically fanatical Cubans. Yes, the Cubans. All that rum and jazz and partying is just a front. In an eyeball-to-eyeball macho contest. But if Cuba is such a threat, why exactly do they continue to allow the US to occupy part of their country? Surely, if they were all that, they could chuck out Jack Nicholson and any number of wannabe Davy Crockett's. So these realists and assorted security geeks, all of whom probably love that movie and think it raises substantive issues about the morality of our necessary military security, get all catchy at people like George W. Bush because he's so frustratingly stupid. Not smart like them. Imagine a weedy, self-important accountant sneering at a mafia don because he failed to claim on the hard hats in his construction business and thus paid several hundred dollars more tax than required. That's what they're like. The US has used international mass violence so many times since World War II that it really is impossible to quantify. It would be fairly impossible to point to any one of these and say with any sort of assurance that they made the US more secure. Yet there are many instances when a pretty robust argument can be made that they made the US less secure. Nearly 70 years of frequent interventions that don't make the US more secure? Maybe. I know this is a bit of a weird thing to say, but maybe US security is not the goal. Let us not forget also that despite 50 years of very clever people pointing out the US empire is destroying itself with hubris and overreach, it is now quantifiably more strategically predominant and far more comfortable about acting outside international law, defying the bulk of other nations, and enforcing its will on the majority, if not the entirety, of the planet. Personally, I do believe that this is the high tide mark and the beginning of the end for the American Empire, but I also know that others in the past have misinterpreted the active consolidation of imperial power as weakness, failure, and loss because of naive beliefs such as those that I've already mentioned. There is another matter, in that in the US, it seems that some of those who would oppose imperial aggression feel that they must point out its wrong-headed, counterproductive stupidity. Again, their ability to believe themselves so much more intellectually able to determine policy than those who actually do so is quite something to behold. But I feel, too, there is an element of fear that accompanies this arrogance. The fear seems to be that any suggestion that there might be an ounce of rationality and purpose in US aggression would be to concede far too much in the battle for the hearts and minds of middle America. It is always funny when the bourgeois fear fascist instincts working of the working class, who don't tend to have any, while ignoring the growing tendency of their own kind to be goose-stepping around the place. But anyway, to me this is where Walter Mearsheim come in. The first aspect of their appeal to anti-imperialists is that they tick this box. The box that says the Iraq invasion was a horrible mistake from the perspective of maintaining US power in the international arena. But that is far from the end of it. There is an unreasonable and quite irrational tendency to give these guys far more credit than they deserve, and the causes are actually quite broad. Firstly, there is their academic standing. On this, I'd have to say that they're actually letting themselves down as much as anyone else. It's not their theoretical content that is at fault, though clearly insufficient. It is the silly, naive understanding of US interventions, the basis of which is both the academic arrogance I've already discussed and a chauvinist and ultimately exceptionalist reading of US interventions. The next reason for clinging to Walter Mearsheimer is the nature of their most strident critics. Who doesn't want to believe these guys when their critics include Dershowitz, Kissinger, and Albright? And that's only scratching the surface of repugnant people who criticize them. And the nature of these criticisms tends to be exactly the same sort of specious bullying that is systematically used to silence real criticism of Israel and Zionism. Then there is anti-Jewish bigotry. In 2006, I debated the Walter Mearsheimer thesis on comment sections online, and it didn't take very long before I was debating those I was debating tended to forget that they were supposed to be referencing Israeli policy and Zionism and started referencing the Jews, sometimes with supplementary epithets. I was shocked. These young, educated people obviously hated the Jews and weren't that reticent to show it. Two things were obvious from that. One was that Israeli policy was fueling hatred of Jews, and this was obvious from the context of what was written. And the other was that the Walt and Mearsheimer thesis is immensely appealing to people who hate Jews. But there is another aspect of anti-Jewish bigotry which is more subtle and widespread. Perhaps it is ironic in a world where one may be accused of being a Nazi just for supporting Palestinian human rights, but there is a sort of anti-Jewish bigotry that is very widely accepted. One, it seems, can talk about individual or collective US Jews with the inextricable inference that they are supporters of Zionism and Israeli aggression and oppression. The discourse of the Israel lobby over and over again references, quote, Jewish backers, Jewish money, or Jewish voters. This is a form of prejudice which is generally, in other circumstances, known as bigotry. The weird thing is that US Jews are increasingly cool towards Israel, while Zionists, including non-Jewish Zionists, are very keen on suggesting that to be Jewish is to support Israel, and to oppose Israel is to hate Jews. The last thing that causes people to love Walter Mearsheimer so much is the thing that disturbs me the most. What seems to be a desire to avoid facing up to the reality of US genocides and a need to cling to the myths of childhood. I'm not just talking here about the need to see the US as the good guys. In fact, even more than that, I'm talking about the need to see the cartoon villain behind genocide. Genocide needs to be committed by sadistic, brutal, twisted Nazis, fanatically inhuman communist Asians, or brutal, bestial, savage Africans. I honestly think that this need to find some sort of exogenous force to explain US brutality makes people very irrational. Let us be very clear. The Walt and Mearsheimer thesis is that the US national interest was harmed by the 2003 invasion of Iraq and that it happened because of the pernicious and powerful Israel lobby. Listen to these excerpts from the 2006 working paper. Quote, most recently, the Bush administration's attempts to transform the region into a community of democracies, that's the Middle East they're talking about is the region, anyway, this has helped to produce a resilient insurgency in Iraq, a sharp rise in world oil prices, and terrorist bombings in Madrid, London, and Amman. With so much at stake for so many, all countries need to understand the forces that drive US Middle East policy. The US national interest should be the primary object of American foreign policy. For the past several decades, however, especially since the Six-Day War in 1967, the centerpiece of US Middle East policy has been its relationship with Israel. The combination of unwavering US support for Israel and the related effort to spread democracy throughout the region has inflamed Arab and Islamic opinion and jeopardized US security. The overall thrust of US policy in the region is due almost entirely to US domestic politics and especially to the activities of the, quote, Israel lobby, end quote. Other special interest groups have managed to skew U.S. foreign policy in directions they favored, but no lobby has managed to divert U.S. foreign policy as far from what the American national interest would otherwise suggest, while simultaneously convincing Americans that U.S. and Israeli interests are essentially identical. End quote. So, the U.S. was trying to turn the Middle East into a, quote, community of democracies, end quote, was it? Does that sound sensible to you guys? Now, I don't know whether I need to refute Walter Mearsheimer or whether in the cold light of day it's obvious to anyone listening or reading that they're talking utter crap. I also love the way they slipped in a racist swipe at the democracy-hating Arabs and Muslims. The problem with the Walt Mearsheimer paper is its depiction of the United States. Israel is described in realistic and accurately cynical terms, its myths debunked fearlessly, but the US is in no way analysed in such terms. The vision is instead of a Disney version of the US. Benevolent not because it tries to be, but because it is inherently so. Doing bad things is aberrant, not natural to the US. Israeli apartheid is against US core values, and so forth. Walter Mearsheimer actually used the term tail wagging the dog to explain US Middle East policy, but what do they think the real US national interest is? In some matters, there's room for debate that their simple-minded approach just does not acknowledge. So, for example, they decry the antagonism generated amongst the Arab populace when, in fact, an inimical Arab street is probably of more use to the US empire than a friendly one. In other matters, they simply have it back to front. For example, they condemn US policies which drive up oil prices. But not only have these high oil prices brought about an extraordinary run of record profits for giant oil companies, in which the Bush administration members had very, very strong interests, but the high prices and continued control of oil resources, including expanded options for strategic denial, has maintained US dollar hegemony and ensured the continued interdependence of China with the US. So let me once more emphasize that the Israel lobby and US foreign policy is not serious analysis. Call it silly, call it fatuous, call it fantasy, it is junk. Just like junk science or junk economics. Okay, these guys probably weren't paid to come up with this, but junk humanities like this are often paid for at the bookstand. This stuff belongs alongside Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, or The Tragedy of the Commons, or Neil Ferguson, or Max Boot, or Thomas Friedman. Obviously, I have a problem with the fact that Walt and Mearsheimer do not distinguish between national interest and imperial interest, which has been the driving force in US foreign policy even before it was formalized when NSC 68 was adopted in 1950. More than that, however, the problem is that they portray the Iraq invasion of 2003 as some sort of outgrowth of an aberrant Middle East policy, the result of the tail wagging the dog. But how aberrant is it? Iraq is the third genocide committed by the US since World War II, in which they have systematically killed civilians in the millions. Much of the death comes about through repeated systematic behaviours extended over periods of years, such that the orthodox denials of intentionality are simply ludicrous. In Korea, in Indochina, and in Iraq, the systematic mass murder of civilians has been a central policy of the US, and this is beyond dispute. Iraq is problematic in that there is no self-evident systematic intense aerial bombardment specifically aimed at civilians, but along with the established fact of systematic killing through sanctions, mortality data from the occupation period indicate systematic, if atomized, killing by occupation forces induced to commit acts of murder by deliberately created situational, procedural, and psychological conditions. These are just the three most obvious and most deadly genocides by an imperial polity that is genocidal by inclination, and whose interventions are usually somewhere along a genocidal spectrum, even if the term genocide itself is reserved only for certain cases. Of its own accord, or through proxies, the US has on many occasions encompassed the deaths of thousands, tens of thousands, or sometimes hundreds of thousands of civilians. It is also a central actor in a global system of structural violence which has taken tens of millions of lives, and which Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed argues is a system of structural genocide. And I'll give a link to his journal article, which is available for free on the blog. So, here is my synthetic bit. I propose that the dog wags the tail. Israel is a strategic asset to US empire, and that is why the Israel lobby is allowed so much influence domestically. More than that, the Israel lobby is a strategic asset to the empire complex within the US itself, as a means of disciplining legislators and countering democratic forces. Suitably, since democratic forces are so seldom a major driver of legislators' actions, there is a far more important accompanying movement to silence dissent at the community level, in the media, within universities, and so forth. How then is Israel a strategic asset? There is more to this than just the Middle East and North Africa region, but that is as good a place to start as any. When the British first decided to give support to Zionism in Palestine, there was dissent and differences of opinion, but one of the most important strains of thought, really a deciding one, even as far back as 1916, was the belief that a Jewish state surrounded by Arabs would be an inevitable dependency and a strategic asset against those Arabs. Remember that this came when the British had decided they wanted to control all of the world's oil. According to Walter Mearsheimer, Israel was of limited strategic utility during the Cold War, but now only fuels Middle East instability and Islamic extremism. But the US empire relies on Middle East instability, and for similar reasons, has quite a love affair with Islamic extremism. After all, it is getting a little difficult to sustain this line of Al-Qaeda as the quintessential existential enemy when the US is so often aligned with it or even providing material support for them and affiliate groups. They've inherited this love of fundamentalist Islam from the Brits, who used it to head off secular modernism and Islamic modernism in Egypt, first in the late 19th century, then in the 20s and 30s, where their support was crucial in the formation of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's the same as Israel's role in the formation of Hamas. Sure, these Islamists don't make great clients, but they make much better enemies than secular nationalists and socialists. The US even helped steer the Iranian Revolution into the hands of the theocrats, creating a fantastic enemy, and one that totally hated the Soviet Union to boot. This was quite a strategic coup, really, and the US still reaps the benefits of it today. Once again, let me say that the US needs instability. It can't intervene without instability, and it can't threaten to intervene. The US doesn't spend loads of money projecting power into the region with air, naval, and ground troop presences to prevent the Red Army from taking over. It does it to make sure that oil profits are spent on US military hardware, or used to buy US treasury bonds, or kept in Western financial institutions as US dollar reserves. Iraq, for example, is aiming to have $110 billion in US dollar reserves in 2013, this year. Imagine that, a country torn by strife, riven by poverty and unemployment, and they put all of that money into the US Treasury. Well, I guess they learned a lesson somewhere along the lines about what happens to you if you don't. US military presence is also to ensure that oil is only sold for US dollars, so that any other surplus producers also maintain dollar reserves. That's what the petrodollar recycling system is about. Having Israel there, a very well-armed military dependency constantly claiming to be existentially threatened by its neighbors, is a massive strategic boon to the US. It is a classic divide-and-rule strategy in a form not dissimilar to the manner in which the US chose Christian minorities as clients in Korea and Indochina and privileged landowners as clients in Latin America. Choosing a privileged minority to form a comprador class is a very old imperial tactic dating back at least as far as the Han and Roman empires. The British practiced it as a matter of course, and while their alignment with the Sunni Arab world is an exception, which I'm not informed enough to explain, it is both noteworthy and faithful. Firstly, that this choice would later allow the imposition of Sunni client monarchies in areas where she happened to inhabit oil fields. And secondly, long before any sort of Zionism in Palestine, the British acted to separate Jewish populations from other peoples in the Middle East, notably in Baghdad, in order to form a dependent comprador class. Clearly, having a distinct population that was dispersed throughout all the major population centres is extremely useful for an empire, although normal practice has been to induce a local oligarch class as the comprador class. The difference with Israel is that you've got basically an entire separate country, but the principle is still the same. And this isn't that much of a secret either. This is more or less enunciated doctrine. The Nixon Doctrine, which was a doctrine of informal imperialism or neocolonialism, was translated by Melvin Laird in its applicability to the Middle East as being support for, quote, cops on the beat, end quote, who were explicitly there to discipline Arab populations. But Israel's utility is also outside of the Middle East and North Africa region. Israel is the tool which the US uses for dirty tricks in many parts of the world, parts in which Israel has no discernible interest at all. These include a history of providing support for apartheid South Africa, including helping them develop their nuclear program, and in providing arms and support to a number of authoritarian Latin American regimes when the US and other Western nations had to maintain a sense of distance from them because of their obvious criminality and cruelty. Now, I would like to remind people here that what I am discussing is the Israel lobby's influence on US foreign policy. The influence of bullying Zionists on the political discourse within the US is not something I would seek to deny or minimize. But let me now put the decision to invade Iraq into context. Let's start with neoconservatives. Yes, neoconservatives are vehement supporters of Israel. Yes, disproportionate numbers are Jewish. But if you actually look at the history of the neoconservative movement, it's not just about Leo Strauss and Irving Kristol. The whole public intellectual side of neoconservatism has always been married to an institutional side, which predates it, dedicated to extending US influence into global domination. Most prominently, it uses organizations like the Committee for the Present Danger or a Project for a New American Century to create the illusion of threats or idealistic goals as a means of justifying brutal imperialism. Using false pretexts, such as the defense of Israel, is bread and butter for these people. Now let us look at Richard Perle. This is a guy who is a born and bred USAIAN, who has dedicated his political career to spreading US global dominance. So what is more striking? That while serving in the Bush administration, he's actually formally giving policy advice to Israel? Or that he has dual citizenship and therefore might possibly be of dubious loyalty to the United States? But the neocons and the Israel lobby were not alone in supporting the invasion of Iraq. In fact, despite the ostentatious enthusiasm of the neocons, it's worth considering the other interests that stood to gain from the Iraq invasion and had obvious influence. Take the oil industry. The Bush administration was so tied to the oil industry, it isn't even funny. In 2005, ExxonMobil became the largest corporation by revenues on the planet and posted world record-breaking annual profits 5 times. Then there's the military-industrial complex. The arms industry not only has capacious lobbying power, it has penetrated every single congressional district as an employer. It's not hard to see, what effect this has on congressional voting behaviours. But that isn't all, because there really is an empire complex that's bigger than the direct military-industrial aspect. During the war in Indochina, the US government inducted certain non-armaments industries into a war economy based not on the exploitation of conquest, but solely on funneling taxpayer monies, that is US taxpayer monies, to these corporations under the guise of prosecuting war. Prominent amongst these were Halliburton, which owned Brown & Root, Dow Chemical, Monsanto, and Bechtel. Need I belabor the interconnection here with the US government in general or the Bush administration in particular with these interests? And then there is the government itself. In the lovely little fantasy land that Walton Mearsheimer infest, the US national interest is best guarded by robust but fundamentally honourable means. Of course, sometimes you have to break eggs to make an omelette, but on the whole, despite their hard-nosed pretensions, Walt and Mearsheimer are suckers for the US pretense of fundamental righteousness. Many within the bureaucratic state apparatus share that belief, but the actual tenor of US strategic behaviour is different, and it's not hard to perceive that difference. US imperial policy has been quite aptly compared to pre-World War II Japanese imperial policy. There is a putatively defensive purpose, but that is translated into unlimited aggression by a belief that only unchallenged dominance provides security. Global full-spectrum dominance is an official policy aim. Obama's rhetorical shift towards multilateralism does nothing to change that underlying fact. Believing that the US can attempt to achieve full-spectrum dominance without committing genocidal mass murder is like believing that the Third Reich could achieve its desired Lebensraum without genocidal mass murder. So it is the people who are willing to take the steps which the vast majority would reject as morally unacceptable who dictate policy despite the qualms of their colleagues. And they do so by dissimulation, as with the neocon pretense of a fanatical desire to spread democracy. So how does the Israel lobby stack up against these forces, these other influences that also benefited from the Iraq invasion? Well, it doesn't. It's puny in comparison. What makes the Walter Mearsheimer hypothesis even sillier is that they themselves claim that Israel doesn't benefit from the policies dictated by the Israel lobby. Well, the policies that they claim are dictated by the Israel lobby. I'm not kidding. For Jeff Blankford, and I should say here that despite disagreeing vehemently on this issue, I have as much respect for Blankford as I have disdain for Walter Mearsheimer. For Blankford, the fact is that Israel does not benefit from the US from US foreign policy supposedly dictated by the Israel lobby justifies the label the Jewish lobby. And why is that acceptable? Because the backers and lobbyists are Jewish? So forget Jewish people, because only rich scumbags actually count? If that's the Jewish lobby, imagine what the Caucasian lobby must be like. So, here is my synthetic contribution. The Israel lobby is as powerful as it is because it is a dependent subsidiary of the empire lobby, which is the enforcement arm of the empire complex, the part used to ensure that any vestigial remnants of democratic governance are fully suppressed. It is not an entirely original idea. Norman Finkelstein, incidentally but unavoidably, showed the historical evolution of the Israel lobby as subservient to US imperialism. He documents this in his book, The Holocaust Industry, which can be downloaded for free, so I suggest actually reading it rather than dismissing Finkelstein because of his views on the BDS movement or the idea of a one-state solution in Palestine. Now, this unavoidably brings me to my final point, which is really more of an addendum than a conclusion. I am taking a stance which puts me in some unfortunate company in some respects. It's not that I have anything against Norman Finkelstein as a whole. He has done some fantastic work. But his BDN stance is silly. Likewise, Chomsky, who is still astute on most issues at 84, sounds like he's completely senile and out of touch every time I've heard him discuss Palestine in the last few years. Not least because he devotes more attention to what activists should be doing than what Israel and the US should be doing. I think that maybe they fear a bottom-up movement will cause a sudden collapse of the Zionist apartheid state, which will bring about chaos and suffering. Well, I too fear that that might be the case, but I know that a continued push for a so-called two-state solution through a peace process is nothing but camouflage for slow, cruel genocide. Pushing for a one-state solution is a risk, but we must bet that the better aspects of human nature will win through if we empower the people, because the institutions that are currently empowered are inhuman by nature. Now I must turn to my closest ally on the subject of the Israel lobby, Stephen Zurnus. So I'll begin with what I actually think is wrong with Zurnus. I'm not sure when I read his book Tinderbox, but naturally I didn't have a problem with his pointing out Zionism as a red herring in terms of a driving force behind US policy in that book. But he had his own red herrings. He kept on about how much of a policy mistake it was to alienate the Arab street and how they inadvertently, or through short-sighted amoral expedients, keep accidentally promoting Islam as terrorists. Okay, I've already mentioned this stuff, but let me be quite clear. From what I think is a more rigorous theoretical position, the US empire benefits from a hostile Arab mass, preferably alienated from an elite who are dependent on US support to maintain their dominance, another common imperial practice perfected by the US, which you can read about in an excerpt posted to the blog with this entry if you so desire. And the US empire gains a great deal from the existence of credible Islamist terrorist organizations whose efficacy is greatly exaggerated to justify attacks on peoples in Muslim-dominated countries. You can argue that my theory reads too much into US intentions and that, and this is often reported by insiders, things are much less coordinated and much more myopic in the actual halls of power. I would counter this by saying that my theory actually coincides with real observed events. You cannot explain decades upon decades of consistent systematic repetition as being a series of errors. It doesn't work. A quick aside here to say that theoretical approaches positing some systemic cause for systematic but unintentional and counterproductive sequences of actions and policies are completely untenable. Without directed and knowledgeable human intent, such systems would be destroyed or derailed very quickly by changing circumstances. In my honors thesis, which you can read at the On Genocide blog, I demonstrate this with regard to such theories when applied to US genocides in Indochina. Like a law of large numbers, you can be certain that within any large polity with complex power structures, someone with influence intends that an action taken have the foreseeable outcome which follows. Thus, systemic theories should explain how structures reliably empower certain agents over others, and not seek to say that structures themselves cause events. That sounds obvious when I say it, but believe me, it is a point that escapes political scientists regularly, and I think that this is driven by a psychological imperative to avoid at all costs the realization that their own peers commit the inexcusable acts that we like to ascribe to those whom we dehumanize and demonize. So, back to Zurnus' tinderbox. That was my main problem with that. It had the same sort of built-in apologism as Walter Mearsheimer, albeit to a lesser extent, because instead of acknowledging full US culpability for its most heinous and bloody acts, it is constantly portraying them as errors. This isn't a minor point either. The idea of blundering, whether the motive is idealism, venality, or amoral realism, is the central plot of US public diplomacy. Look at any insider expose that criticizes US policy but which does not result in the author being hounded, prosecuted, persecuted, exiled, or bumped off. You will not find a single one of these that doesn't frame everything as being a series of mistakes. And in most cases, to ensure that the point is taken, these books are given titles that tell the reader that they're about US policy being a series of mistakes without them even having to open the book. Now, Stephen Gowans has also levelled criticisms at Zunas with which I concur, in a limited way. Zunas promotes US imperial interests by critiquing third world enemies of Western imperialism and supporting so-called democracy promotion efforts, which are aimed at destabilization and regime change. Although he does deny that that is their aim, but I think that regardless of what he thinks, that that is the underlying aim of these democracy promotion efforts. Previously, when discussing Amnesty International, I dealt with the tendency of some supposed critics of US foreign policy who so bend over backwards to demonstrate an even-handed ability to critique enemies of the US that they actually become vicious interventionists promoting war crimes. Well, this is occurring to a degree in Zunas. The regimes targeted are not necessarily the most pleasant, but in 1939, Poland had an oppressive authoritarian government, and supporting German efforts to destabilize it would not have been morally justifiable. That was a rather clumsy analogy there, but no third world regime is so bad that the balkanized, destabilized, neoliberal, neocolonial fake democracy that the West seeks to impose would not be far, far worse. Look at Iraq. Saddam Hussein was one of the most horrible murderous dictators of the era, yet his crimes against Iraqis pale in comparison to those committed by the US and the UK. This applies to Syria and Libya, where Western inflicted suffering has only just begun. This applies to Sudan, now split into two countries with two sets of civil wars, and no solution in sight, as I'm more to the point. As Gowans points out, Zunas is involved in organizations which are controlled and funded by proven scumbag imperialists. Where Gowans goes wrong is in overreading the case. In a 2008 article, he made wildly exaggerated claims which portrayed Zunas as being, quote, tightly connected to Western governments and ruling class activist foundations, end quote, and as a systematic promoter of Western imperialism. I would invite listeners and readers to check out Zunas' work and see whether they think this is feasible. Listen to the recent interview on KPA Faye's Flashpoints and ask yourself, is this really an imperialist? No. Sorry, the idea is stupid. Because of the wrong-headedness of Gowans' overreach, Zunas wrote a very robust rebuttal of Gowans' 2008 article. And he didn't even have to deal with the crux issue of aiding US imperialism by supporting the destabilization of US enemies. Now, Gowans and others of a similar incarnation are convinced that Zunas is more or less the enemy through his stupidity or worse, and that they can respond to his contentions with ad hominem dismissals. Well, that's just crap. Get a grip, people. Get a sense of perspective. Zunas is clearly a cogent and effective critic of US imperialism, whatever mistakes he might make. Likewise, anyone who has a profile dominated by persuasive anti-imperial influence cannot be treated as being a crypto-imperialist. We all make mistakes, and most people are actually at least a little bit compromised by institutional affiliation. But Gowans' attitude towards Zunas is a bit more like those who claim that Noam Chomsky is actually in the pay of the Pentagon, a rumor Chomsky inadvertently started many years ago by highlighting the irony that he worked from a building built and furnished with Defense Department money. So that is why I don't accept ad hominem attacks on Zunas, because they mischaracterize him. But I should remind you that ad hominem arguments are widely considered invalid in any respect. If someone is right, they are right. Stephen Zunas' writings on the Israel lobby are analytically sound and have an empirical backing in that he actually tests Walter Mearsheimer's contentions by looking at campaign contributions, congressional voting records, and electoral circumstances. And if anyone knows of any actual contending analysis, not gainsaying Zunis on ad hominem or baseless theoretical grounds, please do let me know and I will be most happy to read it. Well, that's where I'm going to have to leave it. I'll catch you next time where I may be trying to cram even more words into an hour. You never know. Thanks for listening and goodbye. Here's a little snippet of Low Key doing Long Live Palestine.
While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse at the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of different views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people.